Also, I've had so many people tell me what a good lead she has that I've been really looking forward to the opportunity to hear her speak. So this is double pleasure for me. She's quite active in area service work, and she's our newly elected area chairman. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce Kitty Kay from Charleston, West Virginia.
Thank you. Uh-huh. My name is Kitty Kay, and I am a grateful Al-Anon from Charleston, West Virginia. Hi, everyone. And thank you for coming to my birthday party. When I was a little girl, in Fairmont, West Virginia, by the way, you all from Fairmont, we used to have Columbus Day parades. Being born on October 12th, and it is Columbus Day, my father had an office on the main street of Fairmont across from the courthouse, for you all who know where that is. And we would go downtown, and they told me that parade was for my birthday. What an ego trip, huh? So I'm going to pretend that you all came here for my birthday party. Thank you. And for the person that asked me how old I am, I'm 564 months old. Now, I won't have you figuring it out. I'm 47 today. We're supposed to share with you our experience, our strength, and our hope. And before I do that, I want to thank the committee for inviting me here to speak to you. And we have an extra friend in the place. Is that a bat in our belfry? I hope it's a bird. Please, let it. It's a bat. Would someone like to catch the bat? Well, I hope that's not an omen of things to come, but did he go out? Who knows? Maybe that poor thing has an alcoholic in his life. Needs to be here. Anyway, I want to thank the committee for inviting me to speak, and I hope and pray that I can get out of the way so God can speak through me. I call my higher power God, and I believe that He uses people like you and I to get His message to us. And I hear what He has to say to me through you in meetings like this and in my meetings that I sit around tables at and have heart-to-heart discussions. Anyway, I've already told you where I lived as a little girl and how many years ago that was. As a little girl, very little girl, I started knowing that if I smiled and I danced or I did whatever you wanted me to do, you did what I wanted you to do. So I learned early how to manipulate people. And when I would manipulate you, please you, and then you would please me, kind of like I'll scratch your back and you scratch mine, everything went along fine. And as I grew up, I sort of grew up with that idea that if I present myself to you the way you wanted to see me, then you would in turn do those things that I wanted you to do. You would look the way I wanted you to look and say the things I wanted you to say. I grew up in a home with two brothers. I was the middle child and only daughter. In a family where the mother had grown up in alcoholism and my father was a compulsive gambler. He lived at the Elks Club in Fairmont on that same main street, only a few blocks up. And when I say he lived there, his waking hours were spent there, except for a few hours that he called work, that he went to the office in the morning and reported in. And I think he ended up at the Elks Club at noon, and that was it. He came home for dinner, though. He was a smart person as far as keeping my mother off his back. I understand that now. He took a break and came home, so we always had him home for dinner. But he would leave after that and come home at late hours. Now, I always had access to this man because I knew how to ring the bell at the Elks Club. And everybody must have thought, oh, my God, here she comes again. And they'd probably put their cards down, and he'd come out and give me a quarter, whatever it was I needed. But my mother, while this was all going on, was home, being the perfect housewife. And in that respect, I mean, everything was scheduled. Our home was immaculate, and our meals were well-balanced. You know, the kind of home that was totally dependable as far as, you know, those kinds of physical things being done. And I made a decision sometime in my early childhood that that isn't the kind of mother I would be or the kind of home that I would run, that I would be more interested in what was going on with my children, and that I would marry a man who would be interested in those things too, and who would not be an absentee father to our children. And I had a God of my understanding at that time, and this God that I had was a God who lived up on those clouds somewhere in the sky. And he kept a big black book, and I don't know whether I made that story up or whether someone told me that he did that. And he checked off all the bad things that I was doing, and he saw that I was punished when, you know, I did bad things. So the God that I knew at that time expected me to be perfect, and when I wasn't, he let me know by having something happen to me. My older brother was 10 years older than I was, and we had very little in common, as you might imagine, because he was so much older. And he was an alcoholic. I now know that as a result of the fellowship that I belong to. And I actually, as I grew up, hated this brother because of the bizarre things that he did and said and the way that he acted. So when I got to Al-Anon, it really gave me great relief to know that he did have a disease and he died in that disease, and that I could love him and appreciate the pain that he had gone through in his life. As I said, my mother had grown up in alcoholism, and her father eventually committed suicide as an alcoholic. And you know, I qualified for this program way before I married the alcoholic. I got married in college to a man who was not an alcoholic and who had not been raised in alcoholism and who was a predictable kind of person. And he was very mellow and very even-keeled, and I didn't ever understand this person. You know, I loved him, but I didn't understand how you couldn't have an opinion on everything. You know, my dad, being a compulsive person, had an opinion on everything. And I thought everybody was supposed to. And I grew up wanting to voice my opinion on everything, too. And he would say, that's all right, do whatever you need to do. And I thought, what the hell? He must not love me. He's not telling me what to do. We got involved in church activities and that sort of thing, and I had three sons by this man, and I was very involved in community activities. I wanted this person to do what I wanted him to do, and growing up in a traditional atmosphere of the, you know, 40s and 50s, the husband's work and the husband's image was a total reflection on the family, at least in my mind. And so somewhere I had read and heard that, you know, there was always a good woman behind every successful man. And I thought after a while in this marriage that I must not be a good enough woman. And I better get on the stick here, because in the image that I had wanted to have through this marriage wasn't coming about. And so I started joining all these various and sundry organizations. Some of you will relate that I got yes-itis. And every time someone called and asked me to do something, I'd say yes. And the only reason I really said yes was I didn't want that person not to like me by saying no. And I got in an awful lot of trouble with time and with my time because I was being spread so thin. And we had these three kids. By the time I was 30, my last child was born when I was 30, and I had a child who at that time was seven, all boys, seven, four, and then this newborn child. And at this time, I had many yearnings to find out what life was all about, and it certainly wasn't all about all the things that I thought it was about. You know, doing good works and putting up this front. And I was a rotten, lousy housekeeper, but I could get it in shape if you gave me a day, you know. One time my father came to visit, and he, when my first husband and I were in school, and we lived in my aunt's house at Cheat Lake in Morgantown, and she had this big home, and we just lived in one bedroom after another, and we'd shut doors, and we used all of our linen and piled it in one bedroom. That was like the dirty clothes hamper, you know. And he came to visit, and unexpectedly, and he called me from the airport and said, "I'm here." I had to go by a store and buy sheets before I could pick him up because I didn't have any. Well, anyway, to make a long story short, I didn't know he knew what was going on. But he told my mother-in-law later that she better give me at least a week's notice before she came to visit because I might not have any clean sheets for him. I'm an extreme person. You know, I don't do anything halfway, or I don't not do anything halfway. Either I do it all the way or nothing at all. And I think Mark mentioned something to that effect. My kids became very important to me, and of course the image that they portrayed became very important, but I had somehow, God protected me from absolutely, totally destroying their lives with this same idea that you please other people. And I, as I said, I had these three kids, and I loved these three children. As a matter of fact, I invested probably more of my emotional life in them than I should have. And my role as mother became more important than just about anything in my life. And at this time I decided maybe I was on the wrong track and I should do something about seeking this higher power. I didn't call him that then. But finding out what it is I was supposed to be doing in this life. So I started studying the Bible, going to Bible studies and that sort of thing, and I got some glimpse of a new understanding that I was more or less responsible for my life, and I could no longer blame circumstances and my husband and my children and my friends and whoever else I chose to blame on why I was successful or why I was not successful in what I was doing or whether I felt good or didn't feel good. And so I was really trudging down that road, trying to discover these things. And when I was 36, my first husband died. And brought, you know, God brings home to me things that I would never understand. And sometimes it seems very harsh ways. And when this happened, I truly discovered that I, Kitty, was responsible for my life. I was living 1,200 miles away from my parents at the time. As a matter of fact, I had no relatives close at hand. I had several friends that got more than a yes, I'm okay answer from me. So I did have some support at that time with friendships. But I, at this time, probably had a serenity prayer that said something like, God, give me the courage to change things that I can't accept, okay? So I really had a hard time accepting the fact that I was a widow, the fact that I would maybe have to live the rest of my life alone. You know, I was great at projecting, and I had lived through this marriage and all my adult years projecting, usually projecting good, you know, like I'll be happy when Christmas comes, I'll be happy when I get the new couch, I'll be happy when. I never was responsible for living today and saying, I'm going to find happiness in this beautiful day. Al-Anon has given me that. But at this time, I did get some glimpse of that living one day at a time because I had so many things that I became responsible for automatically as a result of being the head of the household now. And I began reading, and I began having much regret about the way that first marriage had gone. And not that it was terribly unhappy or that we fought or did anything like that, but I started seeing that the quality of my life could have been a whole lot better if I had been willing to do some things. I wasn't sure what those things were. And I made a commitment to myself at that time that if and when, I shouldn't say if, it was when, because I'd already said to God, now God, I want you to look around and find someone for me to marry. Someone that I can make happy, someone that I can show what a good wife I can be to, and that, you know, I can build a relationship that is worthy of what it's supposed to be all about. And after doing this sort of thing, and you realize I'm looking back and seeing all this, this didn't all, you know, come out in black and white as I was doing it. And I read all these books like The Total Woman, and I just knew when I met this guy, he was going to be the luckiest guy in the world because I was going to do all these right things, and I was going to love him, and I was going to be devoted to our relationship. And, oh my, you know those fantasies that we have. We all have them. And so I would meet a felon, go out for lunch or something, and I'd just sit and look and wonder, and, you know, is this the guy I'm going to give all these wonderful things to, and is he the one God wants me to marry? And something would happen, and that wouldn't be the guy. And if these poor guys knew what was going on in my mind at that time, I mean, beware anybody out there. And it was really funny because looking back now, I believe God in, you know, still up there on that cloud, but I believe God up there looked down and he said, well, Kitty, you want a husband. And I was living in Illinois at the time, and I had some ideas since I was born and raised in West Virginia of coming back to this area. And I think he looked down and he thought, well, I'll go along with that. You can go back to West Virginia. And I think he looked around the state and looked down in Charleston, and he saw John, and he thought, here's a guy that deserves this good woman. And you know, you've heard the expression, you've met two people, or maybe you have a couple of people in your family, and you say, God, they deserve each other, right? Well, I think he looked down, and he said, here was John flitting around into the midst of his alcoholism, not really ready to do anything, okay? But he was getting pretty bad. And here was I out there going to be so devoted to this new wonderful thing that was going to happen to us. Well, I don't believe in coincidences. And so I came to Charleston right after God that made that decision, you see. I came to Charleston and to visit a mutual friend that John and I both have. And lo and behold, she said, I have someone I'd like to invite to dinner. And he is separated from his wife and has been. And anyway, to make a long story short, John was the man that came to dinner on a Good Friday in 1977. And we had known each other in college, but only as you would know another fellow student in college. And the first time that I went out with John, I got a suspicious idea that there was something wrong, because I remember counting his drinks. Now, I'd never done this before in my whole life, and he had 8 double scotch and waters. That's what, or scotch and on the rocks. That's what he was drinking at that time. And he still could walk, and he could talk, and he could dance, and he could drive. And never having really seen, or, you know, my first husband drank, and I drank, and, you know, a beer. My first husband had a beer or two, and I might have a drink now and then, or we'd go out and, you know, party or whatever. But I never saw anybody drink like that. And I thought, and then he told me his sad story, and, you know, I thought, no wonder he drinks like that. Poor guy. And I thought, all he needs is a good woman like me who is going to be devoted to taking care of him the rest of his life. And he won't have to drink like this anymore. Bless his heart. And I did love him. I also take in puppies and kittens and, you know. But there was something strange about this. And I saw that, you know, John had all these wonderful qualities. But somehow he wasn't doing the things that someone that had those wonderful qualities would do. You know, he really seemed to want to have a family life, and he wanted to raise children, and he wanted to be active in the life of a family, or at least that was what he expressed to me, and I believed him, and I think he really did want those things. So it was very easy to you know, fall in love with this guy. Now, I want to tell you something that happened to me, and I don't remember it ever happening before. As I started seeing him, and we had a long-distance relationship, I got a knot in my stomach. Now, it was little in the beginning. But there was something wrong here, and I couldn't figure out what it was. And maybe part of it was the fact that he would tell me, he would call me, or he'd do this, or he'd do that, and he might not do this or that he said he was going to do. And I was sort of hanging in the air. And after we had been seeing each other for, I don't know, maybe 6 months, and we had gone back and forth and had conversations on the telephone a lot and so on and so forth, he called me one morning at 2 a.m., and it happened to be on my oldest son's 16th birthday. And he asked me to marry him. And he was blitzed, and I knew it when he called me. And I thought, well, what do you know? God's answered my prayers. So, you know, I said, I thought about it for a second or two, and I said, yeah. Well, now, it was 2 o'clock in the morning my time, but I think it was like 3 o'clock in the morning Charleston time. Now, what is any good, decent guy doing on a Wednesday morning at 3 o'clock calling this babe in Illinois to ask her to marry him? But that didn't go through my mind, because I knew this was the guy I needed to be with. Anyway, I wasn't going to tell my kids right away. I thought, I'll just break it to them gently. But I have a big mouth and talk a lot. And so the next morning, when my 9-year-old was having breakfast, I said, oh, Matt, by the way, John called last night. And guess what? He asked me to marry him. He said, well, what'd you say? I said, well, I told him I would. He thought a minute. I thought, oh, he's going to cry. He's going to tell me, don't do that. I don't want him for a daddy. Whatever, you know. He said, Mom, I want to ask you something. He called you on the phone to ask you to marry him. Now, is he going to send you a diamond ring in the mail? He didn't think that was a very romantic way to ask anybody to marry him. Marry, you know. And I suppose if I thought about it, I'd have thought, you know, maybe there was something screwy in Denmark, too, but I didn't. And I later found out why John called me at that hour in the morning. And sometime in his lead, maybe he'll reveal that to you all. It was only an alcoholic would do it that way, okay? This was in November, as I said, and I have to back up a minute, because in July, before he asked me and made it all official, we were together back here in West Virginia again. I had brought the kids in, and John told me that he was an alcoholic at that time. Now, I don't know whether, you know, he realized he was telling me that or what, but, you know, then he could have been covering up so that he knew I was coming into this thing with my eyes wide open. But, you know, we who love alcoholics are in as much denial as you who have the disease. And so I thought, there's no way he's an alcoholic. He goes to work every day. He has an income. You know, he dresses, even though I'm going to fix that up, you know. But he... You know, I'm going to clean his act up good, but because he could be that man I always wanted, you know. And I said, well, what do you mean you're an alcoholic? You know, I don't understand that. He said, well, I drink a fifth of booze a day. And I thought, BS, nobody drinks a fifth of booze a day. You know, a day, maybe on a weekend. Well, as you all might know, after we got married, I did find out he drank a fifth of booze a day, and that might have been just not telling the whole truth either. Well, between November and June, I just was in seventh heaven, and everything seemed to work out just fine. That's how I know my God wanted me to be with this guy. Because he didn't let anything stand in the way of us getting together, you know? Everything just went click, 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 and there we were. But I just thought about all these wonderful things. I could envision myself not just being a wonderful wife to this guy, but he had three kids. I have three kids. You all know that show, The Brady Bunch? I thought, now, what we'll do is, we will get married, and we'll have his kids a lot of the time. Not all the time, because his ex-wife has the kids, but we'll have them. And when we do, John will come home from work just like the father on the Brady Bunch. And I'll set this big, long table with candles, and we'll sit down, and we'll talk about what went on that day. And these kids, and we'll just have a wonderful time. And it's all, you know, we'll just ride off into the sunset. I hadn't matured a whole lot, folks, I'll tell you. Well, we did get married, and we went on our honeymoon. And I joined John in his drinking, by the way, when we were dating. And the first few times I tried to drink for drink, you know. And then after two drinks or three, I was out, and I don't know what happened after that, but we went on our honeymoon to this lovely place that belonged to a friend of ours. And I honestly don't believe that I can remember much at all about it. I mean, I don't remember much about it. I don't have to believe it. I do believe it, I mean. I was introduced to the piña colada. And we stayed in that apartment making piña colada and eating bagels, or I don't know what we did. It was a good friend of ours who kept his freezer stocked with just, the, you know, breakfast kinds of stuff. Well, I think we went out to dinner once. But after that honeymoon, I decided that I could not join John in his style of drinking, that I would go back to the way I always drank and let him do whatever he needed to do. Well, the first 6 weeks of our marriage went along just fine, it seemed. He came home from work at the usual time. I had the meal on the table. We sat down, and things seemed to go just fine until he got involved with a client that seemed to demand that he meet him in a bar after work. And so John said, "What am I going to do? Poor me. I have to go to a bar." And he was a bar drinker, by the way. So he started coming home later and later, and the dinner would be ruined. And I'd like to tell you about the sickness that I got into at this point in time. When the kids and I had been left alone, when their father had died, we became very close, and we shared, and we were open. And, you know, probably I shared more than I should have with them, as a matter of fact. And we were a close family. And once I got into the alcoholism and really into it, I realized now what I did to my kids. I did more harm to my kids than the active alcoholic did. And the way I did it was, I quit listening to them. The knot in my stomach got about as big as a basketball at that time. I would sit in the den and I would look through the louvered shutters out to the highway that we live on, and I would count cars. Have any of you ever counted cars? Okay, I would say, when the 20th car goes by, we'll eat, whether he's home or not. And the kids would be coming up, "When are we going to eat?" I said, "You have to wait." See, I still wanted the Brady Bunch. And then I'd say, "Well, when the 50th car goes by." And every car that would come down the road, I would get this big surge in me. And I was just getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And my whole life started to revolve around this man and his drinking and his disease. And the way I like to put it is, his life was revolving around his disease and the bottle. And my life began revolving around him and his bottle, or his disease. And he became my obsession. I thought, now if I say this to him, I wrote speeches in my head. If I say this, that'll make the difference. If I do that, that'll make the difference. Sometimes I would get in the car and I would go out to a forest close to us and I would walk by the hour by myself. And I would think, "I'm not going home till after he's home, and then he'll know what it's like to not have anybody home." Well, you know what would happen. Either I would go home and he'd be home on the couch, kapoomed, not even knowing whether I was there or not, or I would get home before he did. He'd outlast me. But my whole life began to revolve around, how can I control what is going on in his life? All under the guise of making this person happy, okay? My 9-year-old was really getting pretty sick at this time. And because of me, I didn't want to discuss what was going on in my life. I didn't want to discuss what was going on between John and I. I was doing all the things that every other spouse of an alcoholic does. I was keeping my children from discussing anything in the presence of the alcoholic. I would make them tiptoe around the house. "Don't talk about that." We began to go into that game of denial. We began to go into prostituting our minds to lie. Peace at any price. Don't cause anything. I let them believe, I didn't say it, but they honestly believed that if they didn't perform in a perfect manner, that they were the cause of his drinking. Okay? Well, I began to feel guilty. I began to feel desperate, frustrated. I went to my priest who had married us, and I told him that we were having bad times, that John wasn't coming home. And he patted me on the head and said, "Oh, Kitty, it's going to take a long time for him to get over that first marriage." Ha ha. You know, he knew nothing about alcoholism. One time John came home smelling like rose, not roses, and I found a number on his dresser the next morning. And, you know, sane people wouldn't do this, but I started going through the Charleston telephone directory by the number. And I'd go so far, and then I'd lose my place. I mean, this was an obsession. You know, this is how sick I got. Here was this woman who had been active in all these things, who had been chairman of the board, who'd done all this crap in her life before, who seemed to have her life together, who couldn't even function. You know, I had to be given permission for everything, and nobody was giving me any permission. I never did find the number. I never did find out anything, and it doesn't even matter. But that's the kind of crap I was doing. I was going through pockets, reading match covers. You know, it was like, it was sick. And this all reflected on my kids. They didn't understand what was going on with me. John would come home, eat his dinner, fall asleep, or whatever, and, you know, it wasn't any big deal. Well, I got so desperate that I thought about suicide because I knew what death was, and that was a piece of cake compared to what I thought I was going through. I would get out of this thing, okay? And what stopped me was the fact that I had these kids, and I couldn't leave them with a drunk. And he's all they would have, you know, at this time there. So I decided that I had better find help or I was going to lose my mind, that I knew I would have to be institutionalized because I was just crazy. I could think of nothing else but what was going on in his life, who he was with, what he was doing, what he was saying, and my imagination was very fertile, okay? I'm sure that John, in my mind, had many more good times than John actually had, okay? I called Al-Anon once because a friend of mine had told me maybe this was my answer. And the person I talked to didn't seem to encourage me at that time, so I hung up and didn't call again for a long time. But when I did call the next time, it was because someone who had heard an Al-Anon lead, she was not in Al-Anon, was in a class with me. I had decided, by the way, that I should go on and take some classes, do something, or I was going to lose my mind. So I did do that. And she and I were having lunch, and she asked me if John and I could come to dinner. And I knew that she and her husband were teetotalers by choice. And I said, you know, there is no way that we could come to dinner because John didn't leave the house at that time without a glass in his hand, no matter where he was going. He had a glass of booze in his hand. And he could go to all the kids' sporting functions and anything they did with his booze, but it would be very difficult to go to somebody's home with a glass in your hand. And I explained to her, thank you very much, but no thank you. And she was the one that really urged me to go to Al-Anon and made the phone call for me and told me where the meeting was. And if I didn't want to go alone, she would go with me. And I decided I would make my own phone call at that time, and I did. And I did get to Al-Anon, and that was down in St. Albans, West Virginia. I was hiding out, as many of us do. And I went there with the idea that I would get help for me, and I think that's why it worked for me immediately. I knew that I was so sick. So many times people come to the program and they know their spouse is ill, or their brother or their father, whoever they're there for, or their mother, whatever, and they don't realize that what is really wrong is with them. I knew that I was sick and needed help. I, of course, had the hope that they might have some encouraging words that I could use to help John. But I really went there as a last bastion of hope. I had already decided that I would leave him, that I couldn't live with this person who was so sick, who didn't seem to have any answers for his life. But I went there, as I said, with that idea, and they encouraged me to stay by saying, give the program a chance. Wait till you have some answers for yourself. Wait till you understand that you have choices, that you're not forced to do anything that won't be beneficial for you. I heard in Al-Anon in the first few meetings that I wasn't responsible for John's happiness, and I wasn't responsible for curing his illness. The responsibility I might have in that direction would be to plant a seed of hope in John. And I never thought about that. You know, I suppose a lot of his drinking years, or most of them, people had told him to quit drinking, but they never said there was hope that he could live a happy, productive life. So when I was given hope at that point that I could live with active alcoholism. But as I progressed in my program, I realized that it was going to be very difficult for me to live with the active alcoholic and continue to do what I needed to do for me to get well. I made a decision sometime about the third or fourth month into the program that I would have to make some plans, alternative plans for my life, other than living in the alcoholic, active alcoholic home. This is only for me. I prayed a lot. I prayed that God would give me those words that needed to be given, that I could encourage John. And he would always give them to me. And, you know, sometimes they weren't delicate, sweet, kind words either. Sometimes they were very cutting words. But I realized that those were the only words that he and I could share and he could hear at that time, and I could make myself understood. I think he heard more than I realized that he heard. And the way I believe he heard was he saw. I became obsessed with Al-Anon, folks, just the same as with his disease. And at first, I made a commitment to the program that I would go to meetings no matter what happened. You know, in spite of hell and high water, I would get to meetings. And there would be times we would have people in for dinner, and I wouldn't say I was going to Al-Anon, but I would say to them, if it was drug out, I'd say, hey, I've got a meeting at 8 o'clock. Y'all mind if I go? You have coffee. I'll be back. And I'd leave. And he would go. He couldn't believe it. But I had to have that spiritual help almost on a daily basis in the beginning in order to function and make my mind rational again and to understand what it was I was feeling. There came a time when I really had thought, I will wait. God will give me the right time to do what it is I need to do for my life. And John and I had 6 children together, 5 boys and a daughter, and all 5 of the boys play football. And we were going to one and another football game, it seemed, 3 or 4 days a week. And he was very attentive to doing that. Drunk or sober, he would come to the football games. And 2 of our sons were on the same team, and we had made discussed going to this game and decided we would meet in his local favorite spa, the bar across the street from his office, and have a sandwich and go to the game. But just like the big bad wolf and the 3 little pigs, John got there early, you know, to make sure he was well lubricated for the game. And he, I'm sure, didn't go there with the intentions of being inebriated, but when I got there, he was inebriated. And for the first time, God gave me a glimpse into John that I'd never seen before. We were sitting there, and I looked at him, and I looked into his eyes, and I saw 2 big black pits of nothingness. And it scared the hell out of me. And I realized how sick he was and that he wasn't getting help and that there was nothing I could do about it. So in that split second, I made a decision that I wasn't going to live with active alcoholism, and I told him that he needn't come home that night. And I left. And I had my 9-year-old kid with me. I'd had a few months of Al-Anon, and my son had had some pre-Alateen. And as we were leaving the bar, he, in my hand, he said, "Mother, how can you do this to such a sick man?" And I get tears when I think about it. Because this kid knew what alcoholism was. And he cried. And I said, "Matthew," I cried too. I said, "This is the first time I've been able to maybe give John a choice. Maybe now he will be able to make a decision. Before this time, I have always been hanging around to pick it up, okay?" Well, John did. Well, he's here, okay? And I'll let him tell you what happened to him during those next few days. But what happened to me was I had good friends in Al-Anon that walked with me side by side each step of the way, that gave me the courage to do what I had to do, who encouraged me, who said, "You're okay the way you are. It's okay to have flaws. It's okay to be imperfect. You don't have to put up a front any longer." But I'm sure glad there aren't any lights shining on my face so you can see all the wrinkles. I thought about that last night, Mark. I thought, gee, Mark's lucky to be here at night when you look so wonderful in candlelight. Well, this morning it's pretty nice, too. Anyway, I'm still covering up is what I'm trying to say. And I probably won't ever be well, because if I were, I wouldn't need my program. I still go to meetings. John and I have not had, a barrel of roses or a bowl of cherries. Our life has been difficult. We've had many things happen to us that we never could have handled if we hadn't had these programs. In the last year alone, we have had we've had two deaths that were very close to us. We've had an upheaval in our marriage that through our program we have been able to work it through. We have become the guardian of a 6-year-old little boy who is from an alcoholic home. It is just such a neat, wonderful experience. And I told you earlier in my life, I projected a lot. I projected into the future for my happiness. And the way I see it now, before I got into the active alcoholism, I was constantly in quest of something to make me happy. Out there, it's going to be happier then. I'll find that happiness when. And then when I was in the alcoholism, I started looking back and thinking, my God, I had that happiness. And now, I really screwed up, so I lived in the past. Al-Anon has taught me to live today. I don't know what today's going to bring. Only thing I know is if I wake up with an attitude of turning my life and my will over to God, that somehow He will be with me to get me through today. And not only get me through, but to allow me to see His hand in what's going on in my life. Okay? I could never have committed to taking a child of 6 years old when I am thinking of the freedom I might have when my 16-year-old is gone, okay? But one day at a time, I have this little kid. And already, he has brought more joy to our life than anything I can tell you about. He knows about the disease. He says to John, John said, "Well, I'm going to a meeting." And Bobby's little eyes get big, and he says, "Are you going to one of those A&A meetings?" And he knows that John has a disease called alcoholism. And he knows that his daddy and mother have a disease, Be careful what you pray for. I prayed for a husband. I got one, just the right one, The one I needed to help me become the person God wants me to be. I prayed for just so many things that have happened. I prayed that God use me. You know when he uses me? Not when it's convenient. Not when I have 2 hours to sit and talk. He uses me when I'm frying chicken. The telephone rings. I'll tell you, I think I have arthritis in this shoulder because I'm doing this number, you know. I'm on the phone, I'm cooking dinner. I can get a meal on, I can almost eat that meal, do the dishes, and still be talking to somebody. You know, yes, I found out now and on you have to learn to be a good listener because most of the time that's what that person needs. God uses, you know, if you ask him to use you, be prepared to be used in the way he wants you to be used. I live in today so tight now that I have a hard time thinking about what it is I'm supposed to be doing tomorrow unless I write everything down. I'm not saying you can't plan the future as long as you don't plan the outcome, okay? And if I don't write everything down and look at it in the morning of that day, I don't know what I'm doing. I have missed things because I haven't checked on what it is I'm supposed to be doing. Al-Anon has taught me that everybody in this fellowship is the same. And when I say this fellowship, I mean all of us. People who are the primary persons with the disease and we who have lived with it. I believe that we have the same exact feelings. We act out those feelings differently. I believe that around my tables that I sit in my Al-Anon meetings, that if we were all turned wrong side out, we'd all look exactly alike. I love the program. I love the anonymity of the program in the spiritual sense, where I don't have to know anything at all about you except that you have feelings like I do. I don't need to know your name or what you do or where you live or anything. And it's so beautiful because that gives me the freedom to be me. I don't have to impress you. You don't have to impress me. And I love it. I have never, ever, you know, in my wildest dreams thought that I could be as free as I am today. You know, I can spill my guts on a minute's notice, and I have to be real careful because sometimes I spill them and the person is not in the program. And I, you know, they just can't imagine anyone being able to say that in that context, okay? So I pray that God uses me, you know, those are all for good reasons too, you know, those things happen too. Pride was one of my very, very big character defects, and I still have to work on that. And especially in my close relationships with my family. You know, as a parent, you get prideful about being a parent. And I have to be real careful not to want to lord that over my kids. I have to be real careful in my marriage with pride, too. And, well, the program helps. What I'm trying to tell you is it's a living program for me. And when my kids, some of my older kids say, "Mom, why do you still think you have to go to meetings?" I said, "Hey, I'm still living, and as long as I'm alive, I'm going to have living problems, and I cannot stay on the right track unless I'm there in my meetings." I also know that if I didn't have my program, and I believe if John didn't have his, I don't think we could be married. Because my idea of marriage was I would jump on somebody's back and ride the hell out of them and expect them to carry me through life. And Al-Anon has taught me that we can be going in the same direction, on the same set of tracks, and sharing in the same thing, but we don't have to be leeches with each other. I cannot begin to thank or be grateful enough for this program. If I live to be 100, I couldn't repay that which has been given to me personally. And I believe the only way I can repay is to be, you know, carry the message, to be willing and to be used by the God of my understanding in this program. And I believe, like it says in your big book of AA, that I will go to any length to stay well. And part of the thing I have to do is my 12 steps and the 12-step work that's involved in that. And I thank you for listening to me and helping me this morning.